Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Your future is important. Take time to plan for what can go right. Talk to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Now, as you heard there in the news, it's been announced today that the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Chris Heaton-Harris, has extended the period during which the Northern parties can form an executive and also announced cuts to MLA salaries. So does this give rise to hope that a deal can be struck to avoid further Northern Assembly elections and possibly resolve issues about the Northern Irish Protocol? For more on all of this, we're joined now from the 27th UN Climate Change Conference in Egypt by Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney. And you're welcome, Minister, to the programme this afternoon. So you will of course have heard that news that the Northern Ireland Secretary Chris Heaton-Harris has announced he's going to extend that deadline for calling a fresh stormed election by 6 weeks, with an option to extend that again further by a further 6 weeks. Do you welcome that move?
Yeah, I do. I was speaking to Chris Heaton-Harris this morning, actually, before he announced what he was going to do. This is something we've been talking about for the last number of weeks in terms of how we could respond to the legal obligation that he has because of the most recent agreement of New Decade, New Approach in Northern Ireland. He had an obligation to either call elections or else to pass new legislation that could give us more time and push elections back into next year, if at all. And, you know, I think it is a very sensible approach to give some space and time. Northern Ireland is in a fragile place politically, and I believe that an election now would have been polarizing, would have been difficult, and I don't think it would have helped us find solutions and compromises to try and address some of the outstanding issues, particularly in relation to the protocol in a post-Brexit era. So for lots of reasons, this is something that the Irish government had looked for, and I think the British government agrees with us on that.
Some concern being expressed in Northern Ireland, Minister, that a precedent has been set now and this could lead to elections simply being put off, leaving Northern Ireland in limbo, pending some sort of deal or compromise or agreement being reached that the DUP would be happy with. Would you have those concerns that Northern Ireland could just be left without any government or devolved administration for an extended period of time now?
No, because this is essentially the legislation provides for an extra 6 weeks, and then also provides for a statutory instrument for the Secretary of State if he wants to use it for a further 6 weeks. So 8 weeks or 12 weeks is the limit here in terms of how he can push for how long he can push this decision out. Of course, you'd rather not be passing legislation when we all agreed an approach in terms of obligation to form an executive and so on. But look, not for the first time, we've had to adapt to tensions and pressures and polarisation in Northern Irish politics. And I think, you know, this was a sensible judgment.
Okay.
I don't believe that an election now would have produced anything positive in terms of what we have to achieve together to protect the peace process, to protect the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement, okay, to get devolved government back up and running in Northern Ireland, and of course North-South bodies functioning again as well.
Incidentally, do you support the move to cut the salaries of MLAs? Might that focus a few minds?
Well, I think it's difficult to justify not doing that, and you know, that is also something that I've spoken to the Secretary of State about. That was very much his decision, but I think it is the right decision, and I support him on it. There's a big obligation now, by the way, though, on the British government and the EU to use this window productively, because the whole point of this is to try and change the political landscape in Northern Ireland between now and the end of the year by finding a way through negotiation, pragmatism and compromise to actually get an agreed approach on the protocol that is consistent with the international treaty that's in place, but also takes account of genuine unionist concerns in terms of how the protocol was to be implemented. And I believe it's possible to do that. I think there is a middle ground here. The EU has already shown a willingness to compromise, to try and find a way forward. And I think if the British government acts likewise, then I think it is possible between now and the end of the year to get a deal that I hope can settle the protocol issues once and for all. Of course, there'll be some people who won't be happy with a compromise, but I think the majority of people in Northern Ireland, if there is a reasonable compromise between the EU and the UK on the protocol, if we can provide certainty and stability in the back of that, then I think we have a much better chance of forming an executive that can function early in the new year.
Of course, the problem is it's not the majority that you need to satisfy here, really, is it? It's the DUP, and they've set out their 7 tests for what they need to see in order to be happy or content with how the protocol is working. And one of those tests is that there must be no checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain or from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. Now, I understand that where negotiations are at the moment is to minimise those checks to as much of an extent as possible. But there will still be checks, won't there? Is that inevitable? There will still be checks.
Yeah, I think there needs to be some, because we have to protect the integrity of the EU single market, which of course extends to Northern Ireland. I mean, that's what the protocol does. But what we can do is we can distinguish goods that are coming from Great Britain into Northern Ireland that we know are staying in Northern Ireland in terms of purchase and consumption, and goods that are at risk of travelling on to other parts of the single market, whether that's into the Republic of Ireland or to some other part of the EU. And we can apply a completely different risk management strategy, i.e. checks, to the goods that we know are staying in Northern Ireland. And we can do that if there is real-time comprehensive data sharing on products that are being traded from Great Britain into Northern Ireland.
Okay.
That's where we are at the moment. We can make a lot of progress in this area to respond to what unionists and many business people have looked for. There will need to be some checks, but we can dramatically reduce the checks burden. Mara Sefcovic, who's the EU negotiator, has referred to making them virtually invisible.
Okay.
That's the kind of progress that is possible here. Can I just say, though, on the DUP, because this cannot be just about one party. You know, we've got to respond to all parties in Northern Ireland.
I think a lot of people would agree with that, Minister, but the problem is, in a way, it has become about one party, hasn't it? Because they are refusing to take their place, and therefore the Assembly cannot run under the rules that are in place at the moment.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't be about one party, but it is.
No, the formation of an executive has become about one party.
Mm.
But actually resolving the issues of the protocol is about a much broader concern coming from unionism. So if you speak to people who vote for the Ulster Unionist Party, if you speak to people like Doug Beattie, he wants to go into an executive tomorrow, but he also has a real problem with the protocol in terms of how it's being implemented.
Yes,
and this is about responding to a broader unionist concern.
I understand. Okay.
Rather than solely the concerns of one party, who unfortunately have linked the issue of the protocol with the formation of an executive.
Okay, but Doug Beattie has also expressed a concern.
Does not have the support of the majority of people in the North.
Doug Beattie has also expressed a concern, along with the DUP, about the role of the ECJ in Northern Ireland. And this is another one of the DUP's tests, but Doug Beattie and the UUP have expressed similar concerns that the Northern Ireland is subject to laws that are imposed by the European Union over which the people of Northern Ireland have no say. Can that be resolved, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, the only role for the ECJ here is in how the rules of the EU single market actually work, to make sure that there is equal treatment right across the single market. And you have to have a regulatory basis and a standard there. And that's what the ECJ role will be. There are many other areas where British law, of course, will apply in Northern Ireland in terms of the regulatory environment. So the ECJ role is actually limited here.
The role that it holds at the moment is what they're objecting to. You don't see any change to the role that it holds at the moment.
Well, I don't believe it's credible that for the rules of the EU single market and the role of the ECJ in terms of the interpretation of those rules, I don't think it's credible that we would apply a different legal base in Northern Ireland versus the rest of the EU single market. I mean, don't forget, the protocol here provides an extraordinary opportunity for Northern Ireland. Not only can they trade freely into the UK, but they can also trade as part of the EU single market, even though they're outside of the EU. And that gives a huge trading and economic opportunity to Northern Ireland. But of course, there has to be a level playing field, and that's where the ECJ comes in. So I can understand the concern there, but I think the role of the ECJ can be limited to a specific area. And of course, that's subject to a negotiation between the two sides.
As I said, we're speaking to you, or you're speaking to us rather, from Egypt at the moment, where the COP27 summit is taking place. I know the Taoiseach talked yesterday in his speech about how loss and damage is a priority. Indeed, four of the six priorities that he identified were to do with climate finance and loss and damage, which obviously are very, very important areas and have merited a lot of discussion over the last couple of days. But scientists and environmentalists here are saying that shouldn't be where the focus is. The focus should be on protection, on prevention rather. For example, Hannah Daly, professor at UCC, made the point that prevention is better than cure, and Ireland still has its foot on the accelerator when it comes to climate damage.
Yeah, no, I met Hannah today, actually. So, look, the truth is we need to do both, you know, and of course, the most important thing here is mitigation. You know, we've got to reduce emissions in a way that limits temperature increases, which will then limit the extent of climate change in the coming years and decades. And that is the most important thing. At the moment, we are not on course to meet the targets that we've set for ourselves. Mm. So the target has been set to limit global warming by 1.5 degrees by the end of this century. On our current trajectory, we're going to be at an increase of somewhere between 2.5 and 2.8. All of the science tells us that would be catastrophic in terms of what the climate change that would flow from that temperature increase would actually mean for millions and millions of people. And so unless we can accelerate our meeting of the targets that we've set for ourselves in terms of emissions reductions, well, then that is the path that we are enabling. And won't be forgiven for, in my view. So that's the mitigation challenge. But there are also other areas. Adaptation, because climate change has already begun. We need to help to finance countries that need to adapt to the new realities of climate. And then we also, in my view, have to put money into what's called a loss and damage fund, which is about recognizing that some countries have suffered enormous loss because of climate change that the developed world has contributed to in terms of the emissions that continues to come from our country.
And the Taoiseach talked about doing that yesterday. He talked about this €10 million that we're going to put into Global Shield. Again, environmental groups, the chief executive of ActionAid, for example, says Global Shield is an insurance mechanism. It's basically northern countries subsidising northern-owned insurance companies. It shouldn't be mistaken for a loss and damage financing facility, and it won't channel funds to communities on the front line. Why did we choose that mechanism?
Well, look, I mean, we are contributing to that mechanism. We think it's worthwhile, but we're also contributing a lot more money. Like we have given a commitment that by 2025, Ireland will be contributing €225 million a year, every year, to climate finance. In the last number of months, for example, we've committed to spending an extra €30 million on the Horn of Africa to respond to drought there between now and the end of the year. Yeah. We've contributed another €50 million to work with UNICEF, specifically around nutrition for young children on the Horn of Africa who are suffering drought and famine at the moment. So these are the kind of things that we are doing that are very much linked to loss and damage and adaptation already. But what we would like to see over time is a more formalized and structured loss and damage fund that wealthy developed countries can contribute to, recognizing the human suffering that is already taking place and the loss of a natural environment that is already taking place in many countries in the world that are far more deeply impacted by climate change than Ireland is. And we're not there yet, in truth. Mm. But by the end of next week, I think the big hope, and I met the Egyptian foreign minister, who's the president of this COP. They certainly have a big hope that by the end of this week, which is the end of next week, which is the end of COP, they will have a significant announcement to make in relation to loss and damage. But there's a lot of negotiation to happen in relation to that, because this is huge money. And of course, we need to make sure that it's well spent.
Okay, can I just ask you finally, Minister, a big reshuffle, or perhaps not a big reshuffle, but certainly some reshuffling coming up in December with the handover of the Taoiseach's job to your party leader, Leo Varadkar. Lots of speculation that Micheál Martin might be interested in your job, in the job as Minister of Foreign Affairs. I don't know if you've heard that. Would you be very sorry to step away from the role that you've had for many years?
Look, Sarah, you know, you and I have been around a while in this business. All I can say is, look, as long as I have the privilege of being a foreign minister and a defence minister, You know, I'll work as hard as I can to make as big an impact as I can. It's been an incredible privilege for me. I'd love to stay in this job if I can, but I'm also a realist about politics and the change that can sometimes come about. So I've had no discussion on this with either the Taoiseach or the Taoiseach. It's really a matter for those two leaders and, of course, Eamon Ryan to determine what the government looks like when the changes happen in mid-December. But, you know, I have a lot to do between now and then, and that's my focus rather than discussing and pondering what might or might not happen.
All right, Minister, thank you very much for joining us this evening. That's Minister Simon Coveney.